About 9.5 million veterans are in the American workforce, and one group called Green Veterans wants more service members to work in clean energy and sustainability. Plus, hospitals in the Chicago area have been sending ambulances away in an effort to reduce overcrowded emergency rooms. But this practice is actually moving the problem instead of solving it. And the centuries-old sport of karate will be an Olympic event for the first time in Tokyo next year. We'll speak with Olympic hopefuls.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Maxey. I hope you're staying warm this morning. It's a little cold for Veterans Day. Coming up later this hour, why some ambulances in Chicago aren't taking patients to the nearest hospital. Plus, we'll talk with two members of the U.S. karate team as they try and compete in the Olympics for the very first time. But first, about 9.5 million veterans are in the labor force, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They work in a wide range of fields, whether it's an office setting, healthcare, transportation, and they're also much more likely to work in federal governments than non-veterans. One organization is hoping to encourage more veterans to consider another career path. Green Veterans connects service members with jobs in sustainability, clean energy, and other environmental initiatives. Not just because it's a growing industry, but because it might actually help veterans readjust to civilian life. And just last month, the organization launched an Illinois chapter. Jessica Kling is the founder of Green Veterans Illinois. She's also an Army Reserve officer, and she joins me now. Sergeant Kling, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Should I call you Sergeant, or?
You can just call me Jessica.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'd like to start with your experience, because as I mentioned, you're an Army Reserve officer. You also have a background in environmental work, whether it's on recycling programs, some graduate school that you did, or starting up Green Veterans Illinois. Have both veterans issues and environmental issues always been a big part of your life?
Yes, I really, first I joined a hunger and homelessness campaign in like with the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group, and I really learned about environmental issues then, and I started taking classes in college, and I learned really how environmental issues impact people just as much as they impact the environment, and I've really always been interested in really helping both issues, like helping individuals in need and the environment.
And when did you start kind of coalescing the two, that environmental jobs or green jobs would be a good fit for veterans?
Well, since I've always kind of been personally interested in it, it's something that I've really thought about for a while. But when I was doing my master's program in sustainable management, I chose as my graduation project to focus on how veterans can transition into green fields. And what I've really learned is that there's so much already out there, so many people that are similar to myself, like looking for ways to connect veterans and green energy jobs. So so that's what I've been, that's what I've learned really since what I've learned since like researching it.
And
there's so many organizations out there. So,
and why do you think it is such a good fit for veterans specifically?
So overall, I think when veterans, when they transition out of the military, they're really looking, they have a lot of purpose like in the military. And I think a lot of veterans really look for a career that they can also have a sense of purpose in. So I think green energy careers really provide that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine coming out of the service, it would be easy to get lost without that complete central focus of the military. And when we say green jobs, exactly what are we talking about? Is that a few jobs or is it a wide range of possible jobs?
Well, our chapter is going to focus on energy and urban agriculture. So energy related to solar, wind, energy efficiency jobs, and urban agriculture like horticulture and gardening. So that's the two that we're focused on. I mean, of course, there's other all types of environmental jobs out there, but that's the two types that we're going to focus on.
Mm-hmm. And when you were, you interviewed a lot of veterans for your graduate work at the University of Wisconsin. What were some of the common themes that you heard from them?
Like I said before, like no matter if they had gone through combat or not, or didn't go through a combat experience, when they transitioned out, like my common theme that I saw running through them was that they really wanted to find another career of purpose. They really kind of missed kind of having that overarching goal of the military. So yeah, that's just some common theme that I kind of always kind of that I saw through my interviews, and not only that, but in the research that I did.
Mm-hmm. And one thing about environmental jobs, it seems as though they're not just good for a sense of purpose, but they're good for things like healing and helping ex-military cope with things like PTSD. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, in fact, like we're starting the Illinois chapter, but Green Veterans, they have chapters in other areas, and that's definitely something that's been a focus on for the other chapters. Like, for example, like the Milwaukee chapter, they work with an organization called Groundworks, and they've had they've trained multiple veterans in horticulture techniques, and like their specific aim is also to help them with their PTSD. So yeah, like it's shown like through research that like gardening can be therapeutic for things like PTSD.
And I know you're not the scientist behind it, but do we know exactly why something like gardening does help with PTSD? Do you know if it's working with your hands or making things grow or just sort of the zen of it? Or is there something biological going on that we now understand that we didn't?
Well, you know, I think really it's finding something to kind of, and of course I'm not, you know, a counselor or anything like that.
Sure.
But what I would say is, you know, I would say it's just something to kind of refocus your attention. When I did interview other veterans, you know, a lot of them said that what really helped them from like depression and PTSD is when they found a different service organizations like Chicago Veterans and Mission Continues, and those organizations are focused on giving back to the community. So, and they said that really helped them kind of get out of their own head and give back to the community. So I would say same thing with like, you know, that's what I would assume, you know, again, I'm not a counselor, but I would say same thing with gardening or other things like that, or just volunteering in general, is kind of get out of your own, instead of, you know, worrying about this problem, how can I give back to others and really find like a more service and purpose with that, and kind of building connections as well. Like if you're isolated, you know, more by yourself, you know, that encourages depression. Then whereas if you like kind of are volunteering and serving with other people, you build more connections, you feel less isolated. So if you're kind of building this common goal with, you know, other people, part of your group, that helps, you know, alleviate depression. That's what I would personally say.
Right. And, you know, I read another interview, excuse me, where you said that there's a stereotype about veterans that they don't really care about environmental issues. And it sounds like that's not what you're finding. Would you say that's true?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That was kind of my like personal perception, what I, you know, perceive from other people is that, you know, are veterans interested in this? Like even when we kind of create our own chapter, I think there's like, you know, people ask some questions, okay, would they be, you know, are veterans really interested in that? And like from what I've seen in my research, there's already so many people doing things similar to what I'm doing. Like I went to a Veterans Advanced Energy Summit. And there's about 100 different veterans there, you know, like either working to start like their own business, or looking to get into entrepreneurship. I had a call for a veteran just yesterday, and he was asking me resources because he wants to start, you know, a business in renewable energy. So that's definitely not what I've, what I found is that every time I kind of turn a corner, I'm seeing people that are just as interested as I, and I am as this, in this subject.
So do you think that that, excuse me, do you think that that's an old image we have of people coming out of the military? That
yes.
stereotype?
Yes. I mean, I think the military, yeah, I think, it, you know, there's a always been a perception, you know, it's like military kind of slants, you know, conservative. So I think, yeah, that's why that perception exists, is because, you know, if you have conservative values, you shouldn't really care about the environment, which so many people, you know, across any political line, it really shouldn't be a political issue. So many people, you know, on either side of the political spectrum, like, really care about this issue. So.
And how many veterans are starting to take jobs in the environmental sector? Is that number, is that number growing? Would you like to see more growth?
I do know, like, specifically in the energy efficiency sector, I do know that there's a higher proportion of veterans in the energy efficiency sector than the overall population. I want to say, like, it's like double than the average population.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, for the overall energy efficiency number, like veterans make up double the energy efficiency numbers, and they should portion it to their population.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit more about Green Veterans. You had an event last month with the Chicago Botanic Garden to launch the Illinois chapter. And what programs are you hoping to develop there?
Last month we had we worked with Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition with our Listen Lead Share event. And one thing that I would like to see is, like, there's our programs or funding specifically targeted at energy jobs that veterans are a priority member. Like, for example, like with the Future Energy Jobs Act, they have priority groups of returning citizens that were formerly incarcerated, foster care alumni, and then certain individuals in environmental justice communities. So, like, for example, I would really like to see veterans as, like, part of, you know, like, priority funding groups. So that is something that we're working with the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition for, is to try to get as much veteran feedback as we can for, you know, when hopefully they do pass that legislation. Other programs, the overall Green Veterans model includes, like, veterans service projects and veterans training. So right now we're all cataloging all of the opportunities that currently exist under energy and urban agriculture. Like, for example, like with Elevate Energy and other organizations like that already have opportunities that exist. They're not veteran specific, but they're opportunities that other people can apply for. So just, like, basically working with them and seeing where we can steer veterans that are already contacting us into that direction, into those programs. Another thing that I would like to see is like veteran specific programs, like the Chicago Botanical Garden. They already have a veteran specific internship, like, throughout their summer, and to be able to see how they can grow that as well. And so that's what we're trying to grow. And also, I have, like, events in the future that would be useful for veterans.
Sure.
Like, right now I'm working on when we can have, like, a weatherization and a utility bill, a clinic with Citizens Utility Board. Looking for events like that will encourage veterans to care about green living and sustainability, and working on how we can increase training and job opportunities, and really kind of putting out there at veterans events what's already out there. Because for me, there's a lot of veterans organizations, and there's a lot of, like, energy organizations, and there are some kind of in-between organizations, but really kind of building that bridge between veteran organizations and environmental organizations.
And just out of curiosity, and I'm just speaking generally, briefly, how much of the military, I mean, how much of the environmental work that people are doing has infiltrated into the military? So how, in other words, how familiar will veterans be coming out of the military going into sustainability jobs? Is the military kind of moving in that direction?
So, you know, of course, I'm not, you know, an expert on energy policy in the military. I can tell you, I've done, you know, I've read about it, I've done like certain research. So like, the military, I would say, you know, of course, like a lot of organizations are a very pragmatic organization, right? So what they, so a lot of organizations, anybody can, you know, research this. A lot of the military, you know, of course, they want to try to save fuel and save as many resources as possible. So, so for example, you know, if they can cut down on how much fuel that they use for convoys, then they'll try to do that.
Right.
So if they can be as energy efficiency, you know, as possible, then they will do that. Like, for example, I've read like about solar installation projects in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? So the military, to my knowledge, you know, of course, that's not my job in the military. Like, I'm a paralegal in the Army Reserves. So for example, like they have like a combat engineers and people focused on those jobs. But if they can use those skills to put on a solar installation, then the military, you know, they will
sure.
do that because it saves them energy and they can have fewer convoys.
Sure.
Because convoys can be a leading cause of death, especially in a combat environment. So
wow.
I would say the military is pretty, yeah. So that is something that,
yeah.
you know, if you have as many convoys,
yeah.
that's a potential risk for soldiers because,
okay. you know what, I'm so
you know,
sorry.
IED attacks, yeah.
I have to stop
oh,
you
sorry,
there.
Sorry.
That's all the time. All the time we have. Sergeant Jessica
oh,
Kling is
yeah.
the founder of Greening the Veterans Illinois. They recently had a launch event. Sergeant Kling, thanks so much for making the time to be with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
If you have to call an ambulance, you're already in a high-stress situation. It means that you or a loved one needs medical attention right away. And luckily, most times, paramedics are there to help. The assumption in calling an ambulance, of course, is that the EMTs will take you to the closest hospital as quickly as possible. But it turns out that is not always the case. When a hospital goes on ambulance diversion or ambulance bypass, it means that they don't accept patients coming into the ER in an ambulance. Sometimes that can mean a patient has to go further and wait longer for care. Some of the laws and oversight around this issue in Illinois were tightened decades ago when a newborn girl died after her ambulance was diverted. But an investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has found that since then, Illinois has been lax in its oversight of this practice. The Journal Sentinel found that some of Chicago's top hospitals continue to close their emergency room doors to ambulances, some of them for thousands of hours every year. John Dietrich is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Kevin Crow is a data journalist at USA Today. They're both with us now from Milwaukee. John, Kevin, thanks for being here, and welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. John, your reporting starts a few decades ago in Chicago back in 1990. Can you tell us a little bit more about Denise Nelson and her newborn daughter, Lenice?
Yeah, so this is a case that happened February of 1990. Lenice Nelson was 4 weeks old at the time, and Denise went to check on her, and the baby was not breathing. So she calls 911. They live five blocks from the University of Chicago Children's Hospital, and paramedics, Chicago Fire paramedics, are on scene quickly. They assess that the child is in cardiac arrest for what later is determined to be pneumonia, bronchial problems. And so they call the University of Chicago to say, you know, we're en route of the serious case, get ready for it. And the ER comes back. The nurse in charge says, no, we can't accept your patient. We're on bypass right now. And so we have the dispatch back and forth. What happens is that They do not take the child there. She ends up being, Lanice ends up being routed over to St. Bernard's, which is not a pediatric specialty hospital, not equipped to handle this kind of case. And she sits there for more than 4 hours. They are able to resuscitate her, but they continue to look for another hospital to take her. And ultimately, she does not live. She dies. She's transported to Cook County and dies later that night, early the next day. And what ensued after that was a big uproar publicly, politically, about how this could happen. How could it be that a child could be five blocks from, a pediatric specialty center and be turned away? And there were hearings and so forth. And it was big news for a period of time there in 1990.
And even though Lanice passed away almost 30 years ago, this is still happening today. What does Illinois law say about allowing this?
Well, so it is allowed under the law. The law was beefed up over a series of years following Lanice's death, and also following the heat wave of 1995 when 18 hospitals in Cook County were on bypass. So what Illinois law says is that all those bypasses, hospitals have to report those to the state, and they're supposed to be coming off those as quickly as possible. And the state, their job is to monitor this and make sure that what they're doing is reasonable, and that when the hours get high, that they are to take action. And over a period of years, what we saw looking at the data, and Kevin can speak to this, but we saw that time and time again, the hospitals would go up in their bypass hours, particularly a few hospitals in the area that had particularly high hospital hours in the Chicagoland area, but others as well. And the state didn't do anything. And then the state did send letters one time in early 2018, yet very little action after that, other than to send these letters. And not no fines issued, no fines have ever been issued, as a matter of fact, in 30 years.
Wow. That's so hard to believe. Kevin, you found that the most common time for hospitals to go on diversion wasn't weekends, but earlier in the week. When experts say some beds are set aside for elective surgeries, that is pretty hard to defend. How much of these diversions do we know are due to financial concerns versus overcrowding?
Oh, in this analysis, I mean, what we analyzed were when they closed. Now, in terms of why they close, that's data that we can't really get our hands on. And so we don't know that if they're closing because they don't have any monitored beds or because their ICU is taken up with, patients who have come out of elective surgeries. So what we know is that, Tuesdays and Wednesdays tended to be the weeks for the hospitals that were diverting for heavy amounts of hours. Tuesdays and Wednesdays tended to be the days that they had the highest amounts of diversion. Or bypass. And that lines up with interviews that we've done with experts that say, yeah, those are kind of the times where they tend to do a lot of elective surgeries. However, it's important to note that that is not...
It's not causal
link. We
have
no causation there.
Right. Huh. And then I think people would be very surprised to know that apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, you can, if you drive and walk into the ER, the hospital has to take you. But if you're in an ambulance, which you'd think would get more attention faster, they can bypass you. Is that right?
That's correct. It's one of the sort of head-scratching parts of this. And again, to be clear, this is not just happening in Illinois. This is a practice across the country. Some places have ended it, but it's continued in a lot of places. And that is one of the head-scratching parts of this thing is under federal law, if you drive up, walk up, get dropped off or driven, take Uber, whatever, you under federal law must be assessed by the hospital, something called EMTALA. And that's about 80% of the patients who come into a typical emergency room across the country. And ambulances, if they are alerted, and this is part of the legacy, if you will, of the Lanice Nelson case, we can talk about that, but it ended up going up to the federal court level. One of the legacies of that case is that hospitals cannot be sued when an ambulance, if they're turned away before they get to the emergency room. And federal rules consider bypass a quote-unquote courtesy for a hospital that determines they are unable to accept that that ambulance at the time. So that is true. And we've heard of cases where people will be aware of that. There's a case in Massachusetts where I know a guy was having a heart attack, and he drove himself to the hospital because he knew that the best cardiac center at that time, since then Massachusetts has ended diversion, but he drove himself to the hospital having a heart attack because he knew the best cardiac center in the city was on bypass.
Okay, that's insane. So, Kevin, do you know how this filters down to the rest of the state? Have you just studied the Chicago hospitals, or do we know something about the rest of Illinois?
No, we know. We looked at numbers for all the hospitals in Illinois. So there are about 180, 185 hospitals who report into this system that is run by the Illinois Department of Public Health. And so what they do is every time that they go on bypass, they enter it into a web-based system. And so from there, all of these kind of local regional EMS directors can see which hospitals are going on bypass, when, for how often, how long, so that they can relay that information to the paramedics and EMTs who are out in the field picking people up. And primarily what we found is bypass is heaviest used in the Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I was checking out the area of Champaign, in Champaign County, neither of the hospitals who have emergency rooms there had gone on bypass in the last year or two. And so it is, there are some hospitals outstate who go on bypass every now and again, but it is primarily the Chicago area.
And what does the staff that you spoke to from the hospitals say about this? I mean, they can't be, I mean, I don't want to assume, but I am kind of assuming that nobody wants to turn away patients in need. So what have you heard from them? John?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So,
that's okay.
Yeah, so the response from Northwestern, Advocate Christ, University of Chicago Medical Center, those are the three big ones that have a pattern. They have disclosed that they are crushed with volume, that their emergency rooms are extremely busy, and that this is a safety issue, that it is safer for the patient to be sent to a different hospital that's more equipped. The problem with that is that, you know, when you divert, it's sort of like closing the lane of the freeway. It spills over somewhere else, and other hospitals end up getting that, and then eventually they have to divert. So it's really not a long-term solution to this at all. And, I mean, the other thing that they, you know, note is they said, well, again, our volume, but again, Cook County, Stroger Hospital, which is an extremely busy, and that's the public safety net hospital in Chicago, they don't ever go on bypass. So they've figured out a way through their processes to fix the situation. The other thing is, I think the situation is tough. And I think that as folks who work in emergency rooms hear this story, they feel somewhat like attacked by this premise that mm-hmm. like this is something that we need to get some breathing room. The problem is that they, in hospitals that are not reformed, are sort of hung out to dry. You know, what the experts have found is that the problem is not actually in the ER. It's in the rest of the hospital. It's in the elective surgery humps that happen early part of the week. It's in admissions, discharges, all sorts of processes that make it difficult for those emergency patients to be sent off into other parts of the hospital. So it's sort of like a log jam at the back door of the ER. And so a lot of the ER staff are doing heroic jobs, Herculean, every day to try to keep up with this volume. And what they are really doing is being, stuck with a volume that is not emptying, you know, so not a front door problem, but a backdoor problem. And, you know, in terms of talking to these hospitals, they said, we're working on it. And yet we see through the data, particularly, not huge improvement. And in right. some cases, maybe short-term improvement, but then the bypass hours return.
And
then we've seen that in other places. Again, it's just not just Illinois, Chicago area.
Well, I was going to say, isn't it true also that, for instance, Massachusetts outlawed ambulance bypass, and really there wasn't any big overcrowding in ERs. So it seems like it's kind of inefficient to begin with.
Yeah, it's when you think about a process where you as a sort of a normal way of doing business shut your doors periodically, that would indicate that you have a process problem. And that's what the folks in Massachusetts found, is they said this is actually distracting to our care. This is, and when they allowed diversion, it was actually sort of an obsession of the staff. Are we going to go on diversion? Are we not? And when it was taken off the table as an option, and they gave them time to do it, 18 months or so, to reform their operations. And they still have a lot of volume at these hospitals in Boston. Mass General is one of the largest volume hospitals in the country. So it's not as if they don't have the volume, but what they found is all sorts of ways without going to diversion, which again is only affecting 20% of your incoming cases anyway, and it's a reactionary thing. But when they took that option off the table, what they found is that everybody had to work together. The emergency room wasn't on their own. You know, it was a whole hospital issue, and they had to tackle this together in a process-driven approach. And when they did that, they saw outcomes that not only were more patient-focused, that people were being taken not only to the hospital that was best and closest to their condition, but if they were less acute, that was just what they want, where they wanted to go, the hospital that was close. So for visits or things of that nature from family. So there are all sorts of outcomes. Plus they found that the turnaround time from paramedics and waiting time in the ERs and so forth did not get appreciably worse because, again, the key was they reformed the rest of the hospital.
Okay, so we just have a couple minutes left. To either of you, just quickly, how is this affecting low-income communities?
So there have been studies looking at this issue of how it falls disproportionately on different groups. Ambulances tend to be used by poor people, older people, and people who are sicker. And so those populations, when you get diverted, those populations, the effect lands harder on them. In addition to that, there's some research done by Dr. Shaw from University of California, San Francisco, an ER doc out there, and a researcher who's found that there's a disproportionate effect on African-American patients, particularly with heart attacks, finding that their outcomes and their heart attack mortality rates were higher at times of diversion. And we also found that safety net hospitals, when they go on diversion, the private hospitals nearby that treat fewer poor people, they tend to go on diversion faster. So we have these indications that this practice has a disparate effect on the poor, on the elderly, and on sicker people.
Okay, and super, super quickly, since you published the piece, what has response from lawmakers been?
Well, so right now we have a couple on both on the state and federal level. We have Senator Van Pelt and Representative Flowers are both discussing having hearings on this in the Illinois legislature, and Representative Bobby Rush in Congress is considering legislation on that. We also heard from Governor Pritzker's office that said that they're reviewing the processes and so forth. So at this point, there's definitely been a lot of awareness about this issue, and discussion continues.
All right. That's about all we have time for. I'm sorry, there's so much more we could talk about. That's John Dietrich. He's an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kevin Crowe has always been also been with us. He's a data journalist at USA Today. They've been investigating ambulance diversion across the country, including here in Illinois. Thanks so much for being with us, you guys.
Thanks, Gwen. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Gwen.
Coming up after the break, karate will make its Olympic debut at the 2020 Games in Tokyo. We'll speak with some Team USA athletes training now. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. So the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo are still months away, but of course, athletes are training now, and many have, in fact, been training most of their lives for a chance at gold. And for the first time, you can add karate athletes to the limp of Olympic hopefuls. Karate, the ancient martial art dating back to the 14th century Japan, will be included in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. That's after a nearly 40-year battle to get the sport in the Games. We have two members of Team USA Karate joining us to tell us more. Tom Scott is on the line from Texas, outside of Dallas. He's ranked third in the world by the World Karate Federation and is a Pan American Games gold medalist. Also joining us is Sakura Kukumai. She's a world bronze medalist and eight-time USA national champion from Los Angeles. And that is just to name a very few of their many karate accomplishments. These guys are so, so good. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hello. Hey, Tom.
These guys are teammates, so they know each other.
Thanks for having us.
It is my pleasure. So World Karate Associations have been trying to get karate into the Olympic Games for a long time. You guys have been waiting a long time for it to become an Olympic sport. What's that wait been like for you, Tom?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think, and Sakura can attest to this as well, we've always been a part of Team USA as far as a recognized sport here in the States that, you know, when we participate in the Pan American Games and other Team USA multi-sport events, but just never the Olympic Games. So, I mean, I can say, and Sakura would agree, that we both have been training as Olympic-level athletes, you know, for as long as we've been involved with Team USA. And the day that karate made it into the Olympics, our workouts didn't change, you know, our schedules didn't change. It was an exciting day for sure, but you know, we were, you know, I guess already awaiting it, you know, so we've always been putting in that kind of level of effort.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Sakura?
I mean, Tom explained it perfectly, but, you know, we've been, the reason why we're here is because we love the sport from the very beginning. I, along with Tom, probably too, but we trained karate because we just love the sport. We just love the martial art. And I'm glad that, you know, I continue to pursue my goals and dreams up until now because the opportunity just came to us in a way, you know, like mm-hmm. It's kind of funny that timing and everything worked out, but I was training. We're all training. We had our own personal goals and now the Olympics are in the picture and who wouldn't want to train for the Olympics, right? So I'm very excited. I'm very thankful for this opportunity. And it's really, the timing just worked out perfectly.
So I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What took so long? Is this a matter of popularity in the sport? Is it super political? Is this above your pay grade? I'm just saying, what took so long?
I think a little bit of both of those. I know it can be very political and also, you know, because we've seen other sports with less world participation, but maybe more money make it in or, you know, and just we've seen it all. I think maybe some poor campaigns early on where we weren't as an organization and worldwide maybe promoting ourselves as well as we could have and just things like that can all add up in the end to, you know, an unsuccessful campaign. But, you know, I think the being in the host country that certainly, or the host country being Japan, certainly has assisted this time around.
And am I right in my knowledge that it's not going to be in 2024 in Paris? So it's a one-time thing, or is the Federation trying to get it back in later? That seems kind of odd.
Certainly trying, but at the moment, correct.
Yeah.
It's a one-time thing. Paris, it's not official yet, but so far they have not put us in the proposal.
Huh. I guess
it'll be nice for Qatar to get back in, because there's the population is huge around the world, but like Tom said, it's not official yet, and I really do hope that, you know, karate being in Tokyo, and I hope the world sees how great the sport is and the martial art, because, you know, we're the same as other athletes.
And can you guys both tell me a little bit about how you got into it? I assume you started when you were very young, and I believe you both practiced different styles of karate. Can you tell me when you started, Tom?
Sure. So, you know, it's funny, especially now that we're an Olympic sport, you know, in the United States, people don't start karate because of the sport. They start karate like I did. My parents looking for their son to have a little bit more confidence or
discipline, perhaps.
I teach plenty of kids who need discipline, who need a little bit of a work ethic, who need some more exercise. So people start karate because of those reasons. I'd be curious to hear why Sakura started karate, but
well, you will, you know, in just a second.
It's part of why we, you know, we have a mission here, you know, in Texas to try and spread awareness of the karate athlete, that, you know, there's a tremendous sport behind it. Clearly, you know, Olympics or not, there's still a wonderful sport that has benefited so many. And still retains that entire other side that other sports don't have, which is that lifestyle and learning life lessons and things like that, that other sports just don't have. So very, very unique sport for sure. But yeah, I started when I was 8 just to try and get to, you know, I was trying all sports at that time, but to try and build some confidence.
and I should just say, for people who don't know about the sport, Tom, you compete in kumite, which means fighting or sparring. And
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Sakura, you compete in kata or forms.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So just to give our listeners an idea, kumite is in a ring with an opponent, and you're trying to score by punching, kicking, and blocking. And Sakura, you are doing a choreographed one-sided fight with punches, blocks, kicks, but you are not with an opponent. It is just an individual sport.
Mm-hmm.
And having said that, can you tell me a little bit about how you got into the sport?
Yeah, so I started when I was 7, when I was in Hawaii. My mom basically threw me into a class just so that I have something to do after school. It was at a YMCA, so it was not a karate school, but I stuck with it because I just loved being around people in the karate school, what we call the dojo. To me, it was a safe place. It was where I was able to express myself. Like Tom said, I was not a kid that had, you know, confidence in myself too. So karate definitely helped. And I've done both kata and kumite because our dojo and reinforced us to do both, because as a karateka, as karate athletes, it's our job to master both disciplines. But, you know, as we get older, as we get to a certain age and when you're competing, you kind of have to, you choose either kata or kumite. And for me, I chose kata. I wish I could, you know, compete in kumite because I love to spar too. But I chose kata basically because, you know, you're basically fighting against an invisible opponent. You're telling a story of a fight, and every movement has a meaning, and every block, you know, kicks have applications behind it. So it's a very artistic discipline, and I really love training and performing it.
Yeah, and by the way, exactly what skills would you say you need to compete as an individual? You're not measuring yourself against anybody else. There's no clock.
No.
There's no points. I mean, you're not getting points along the way like Tom is every time he scores a kick. So what kind of focus and what kind of skills do you need for that?
I mean, I always like to say it's kind of like figure skating, but without music. So they're looking at, you know, they're looking at how fast you are, how they look at your technique, they look at your precision in each technique, because unlike figure skating, you cannot change the choreograph. It's already set. So every single athlete is doing basically the same choreography. So it's your job to either show it as, I don't know, faster than the other athletes or stronger. It's a very, the longest is 3 minutes, I believe. And it's very complex. It's very technical, but it's also, I think it's very artistic at the same time. So it's a matter of how much you can grasp. Right. The referees and the audiences who are watching your performance, because you know, all you can hear is the sound of the gi and like your breathing, and that's it.
And so, I should tell the audience that the gi is the costume or the yes. uniform, and it's made out of very, very, very thick cotton. So with your movements, it makes a loud noise.
It makes a snap.
It yes. makes a snap. Yeah. So both you guys, you've come to obviously the top level of your sport. And I know that in karate, they say that a black belt is just a white belt that never gave up. And I'm wondering, did you guys go through that period, you know, largely it happens in adolescence where you're just like, okay, I'm done with karate, and something motivated you, possibly your parents, to continue. Did you guys go through that?
Well, I think, you know, what again, the uniqueness of karate is that, you know, when I got, you know, you started in traditional classes without the sport and just learning the techniques and training your katas, you know, and when maybe as a 10-year-old I got a little bored or fed up with that, I discovered, you know, sparring and competition. And then when I was 17, you know, and been competing for several years, maybe getting interested in trying to get my next black belt, you know, I think whereas other sports just have the game, you know, we have, you can get into your curriculum, you can get involved and deep and have goals, you can get into the sport, you can get into teaching, of course. And so there's just so many avenues, and routes to live out your karate. And when one is waning, you know, the other one comes through and helps motivate you. So they kind of, the different aspects come together. And that's what Sakura is a great example too, you know, where she's not, she knows her traditional training, or I'm trying to get away from saying traditional. I'm going for more saying authentic, you mm-hmm. know, just real karate, you know, that she has a background in too. And so many athletes that are teammates of ours are sport only, and they, you know, can get tired of it all sometimes. So I think we're both lucky to be in good positions in our activities.
And Sakura, just before we mm-hmm. wrap up, just one last question. Yes. What does it mean to you to have the Olympics in Japan next year? Because it was the mm-hmm. birthplace of the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it means everything to me in a way. I was born and raised in Hawaii, and it's where I started karate. It's where, you know, I looked up to all these athletes who taught me karate in Hawaii, but I also have a background in Japan too, because my family's from Japan. I went to school there because I wanted to learn more about karate, and to know that, you know, karate is in the Olympics in Tokyo, where I've actually competed in the venue several times. It's going to be the same location as the Olympics. So it's very emotional to me to go back to Japan to compete in the Olympics, representing my country, but also, you know, representing my family too, back in Japan. So it really means a lot. And I know that there's still a long time until the Olympics. We still have 6 more tournaments that we have to compete in. Before we qualify, like officially qualify, but it will mean the world to me just to be on that stage, surrounded by everybody who has supported me along the way.
Well, I wish you the very best of luck, and we will be following you, Tom Scott and Sakura Kukumai. Both members of Team USA Karate, thank you so, so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Gwen Maxey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.